Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. For his book, Rapper's Deluxe, USC professor Todd Boyd, a.k.a. the notorious PhD, did not want to write just a musical history of hip-hop, but a cultural history. For Boyd, hip-hop culture has so permeated our lives, it's become synonymous with American culture, influencing the way we talk, dress, play sports, even the way we play politics. This hour, we trace this five-decade shift from musical subculture to cultural movement, with Boyd and with you. Where do you see hip-hop's influences, either subtle or bold? Tell us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. You may remember Super Bowl's halftime show in 2022, featuring a composite Compton Street with performances by Kendrick Lamar, Mary J. Blige, Eminem, among others, and opening with Dr. Dre and Snoop.
West Coast, make some noise!
For my guest, USC professor Todd Boyd, it was a capstone of sorts for hip-hop. A triumph, he writes in his new book, Rapper's Deluxe, an indication of how much has changed. Quote, what was once marginal now sits firmly in the center of American social, cultural, and political influence. From its emergence in the 1970s to celebrating its 50-year anniversary in 2023, hip-hop had not only conquered the United States, it had effectively created a world of its own. Todd Boyd, also known as the notorious PhD, joins me now. Welcome to Forum, Dr. Boyd.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It was the LA Times, right, that first called you that, notorious PhD?
Yes, the LA Times labeled me notorious PhD sometime back. I didn't name myself, as some people assume.
So what was it about seeing hip-hop in this way at the Super Bowl that for you solidified its central role in American life?
Well, I think there are several factors. You know, if you think about it, the Super Bowl halftime show has become what I think is the most mainstream venue in American culture. You know, the Super Bowl, and particularly the halftime show, is one of the few things that everybody still watches at the same time. And, of course, there are, you know, numerous people who perhaps are less interested in the game and maybe more interested in what's going on at halftime. So there's the stage itself, which, of course, is a global stage. And the fact that in 2022, the Super Bowl was at SoFi Stadium in Inglewood, of course, part of Los Angeles. And to have Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, Kendrick Lamar, as well as the others, you know, perform at this mainstream venue in Los Angeles, it reminded me of Michael Jackson performing at the Rose Bowl back in 1993. I was actually in attendance at that Super Bowl. And because, you know, there were no NFL teams in L.A. for a long time, you know, the Super Bowl was not in L.A., but here it was returning to L.A., and you had, you know, these icons of L.A. and certainly L.A. hip-hop and Dr. Dre and Snoop headlining this event. And I just thought about the fact that back in 1993, when Dre and Snoop were really, you know, kind of dominating what was going on in hip-hop culture, there's no way that the Super Bowl would have considered them appropriate for the halftime show. I mean, Michael Jackson was the performer, and there's, of course, the story itself behind how the NFL recognized this as an opportunity to keep fans, you know, watching even though it was halftime as opposed to turning to another network as they had done previously the year before with In Living Color. So I just thought about how Dre and Snoop couldn't have been invited to perform at the Super Bowl in Pasadena. But here it was all these years later, and they were center stage in Inglewood, and it just to me served as an effective metaphor of how far hip-hop had come from being really regarded negatively by many people back in the early 90s, but by 2022, it was all considered mainstream.
Yeah, and you have talked about how you see its mainstreamness, its centrality every day. I think you've said you even hear conservative right-wing politicians referencing hip-hop without even knowing it sometimes. I'm so curious if you have an example in your head of that.
Well, if you just think about the words that circulate through our society readily now, words like diss, for instance, to, you know, disrespect someone.
Yeah.
Or when people say, I want to give a shout out. you know, I mean, you don't even think about the origin of where these words come from. They roll off the tongue so easily. But these are words that came from hip hop culture. You know, I remember Marco Rubio a few years back, and he was criticizing Jay-Z about going to Cuba. And he said something to the effect of, I always liked Tupac better anyway. And so here's this conservative Republican senator referencing Tupac. you know, and it didn't come across as anything special or unique or outstanding. But the fact that he, you know, felt compelled to reference Tupac spoke to just how mainstream the culture has become. And one of the things I say in the book is that, you know, quoting Jay-Z, we didn't cross over, we bought the suburbs to the hood. So it's not as though hip-hop compromised itself to be embraced by such entities. It's that the culture over time became so mainstream that, you know, when someone is using language and they don't even think about where it's coming from, and if you were to examine it, it might contradict, you know, their own position. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, that distinction between crossing over versus bringing the suburbs to the hood is an important one. And I guess it makes me wonder, who would you define as a crossover artist versus what hip-hop artists did?
Well, I think, you know, if we go back to, let's say, the 1980s, you know, the era of Michael Jackson, Prince, Whitney Houston, Tina Turner. These are all black musical artists who were considered crossover. Mm-hmm. You know, when hip-hop was still developing and kind of expanding its reach, but not very popular outside of, you know, hip-hop supporters. And the thing about all these artists, I mean, you know, Michael identified himself as the king of pop. you know, that music was music that appealed to people across, you know, multiple social distinctions in our society and beyond. And I think the same with all those artists. And so if you look at that period of time, and certainly before, artists who were black but who created music that had appeal beyond black audiences were considered crossover, and this was a marketing strategy. This was something that record companies sought. They wanted the music to, quote, cross over. But in terms of hip-hop, you know, hip-hop didn't make any overt effort to cross over. And if you think about, you know, through the years, controversy about the language of hip-hop, some of the topics being taken up in hip-hop, you know, hip-hop in a lot of ways did everything it possibly could not to cross over. And in spite of this, it was embraced and embraced by a lot of people who I have come to find out over the years saw the music as rebellious, and the fact that it wasn't crossing over, the fact that it wasn't trying to be mainstream made it that much more appealing. I think there's an authenticity to the culture that is different than what came before it. And so to this extent, you know, the desire to cross over once hip-hop started to expand, if you're trying to cross over, you're being ridiculed. You're being seen as inauthentic. It's about remaining true to the core of hip-hop, and eventually the culture caught up, I think, is the way I would read it.
Mm. We're talking with Dr. Todd Boyd, professor of cinema and media studies at USC, about the impact of hip-hop culture. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the audience, join the conversation. Audience, tell us, where do you see hip-hop's influence in American culture, whether big or small? You can tell us by emailing forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels at KQED Forum. Give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. We were just talking a little bit ago about politics, and you talk about how President Obama really nodded to hip-hop, really brought hip-hop into not just the political arena, but the presidential arena. And I loved your story about his gesture of brushing dirt off his shoulders. Can you talk about that moment and why it stood out to you so much?
Well, of course, in the 2008 campaign, there's a moment when Barack Obama on the campaign trail is talking about his critics. And he says, you know, what I do is I just brush my shoulders off. And he, you know, imitates this gesture. And of course, this is a reference to a, you know, Jay-Z song. Brush your shoulders off as a metaphor for kind of, you know, dismissing critics or dismissing things that you see as not being so important. And for the presidential candidate who would eventually become the nominee of the Democratic Party and ultimately the president of the United States to engage in such a gesture, which is very much a hip-hop gesture, and he's sort of relying on, you know, people recognizing that. And he's also indicating that he himself is a fan, that he's familiar with the culture. And to do it in that way, I think, was funny, but it was also quite effective in demonstrating that Obama saw himself connected to hip-hop culture and having been influenced by it. And once he becomes president, you know, rappers are invited to the White House. You know, rappers are very visible. There are connections he makes to the NBA. You know, and these are things that historically, you know, if you're a sports fan, you know, we have this history of teams being invited to the White House when they win championships. But there was something about watching Barack and Michelle Obama interact with, you know, prominent athletes or cultural figures from hip-hop that felt more authentic, because it was an indication that these were individuals who had connection to the culture beyond simply the formality of the presidency. And of course, since that time, you know, I often refer to President Obama as the tastemaker in chief. I don't know that I've ever seen a president, you know, who puts out, you know, a list of his favorite books or favorite music or favorite, you know, movies or what have you. And so I think he's very connected to the culture. He demonstrated this during his presidency, and he's continued to demonstrate it since then.
Hip-hop, it's more than just the music. It's a culture, and we're talking about it with Dr. Boyd. We'll have more with him and with you after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
You can't cope, you should have broke, because I ain't no joke.
Busta Rhymes, in effect. Shaheed is in effect. Fife Diddog is in effect. Check it out and give me my spec.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about hip-hop this hour, the impact that hip-hop culture has had on our lives, with Dr. Todd Boyd, professor of cinema and media studies at USC. He has a new book. It's called Rapper's Deluxe: How Hip-Hop Made the World. And you, our listeners, can join our conversation by calling 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, at our email address, forum@kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels. We're on X, we're on Instagram, on our digital community, on Discord. And listeners, tell us, where do you see hip-hop's influences in American culture? Are you a fan? What made you a fan? Are there moments when you realize just how mainstream hip-hop has become? Did you love those moments? Did they make you cringe? We're so curious about the role that hip-hop has played in your lives. And, you know, Todd Boyd, one of the things that you have talked about, well, let's just talk about, I asked this question about whether or not those moments of becoming mainstream, what listeners' reactions were to those moments, because it really did start as such a subculture. And you even talked about how if it was popular, you ran from it, which is probably what drew you to hip hop. So talk about some of those early days. Like, what do you credit as the real, I don't know, we know the Kool Herc party as the birth of hip hop, but what do you credit as what gave it the kind of momentum? What was happening in the culture that gave it the kind of momentum that it developed?
Well, you know, for the early years of hip hop, it's something that you have to be in the locations in New York where the culture's developing to experience it, to participate in it. And so throughout most of the 70s, hip-hop is what you would call an underground culture. But of course, in 1979, you have the release of the single Rapper's Delight,
yeah,
which of course I'm sort of remixing with the title of the book. And Rapper's Delight, which, you know, has its own kind of curious backstory, is what allows people outside of those spaces in New York to hear an example of the culture. And it's public for the first time. And so, you know, in the early days, the early late 70s, early 1980s, you know, Sugar Hill Gang, Curtis Blow, Sequence, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force. There's not a lot of music to listen to on the radio. There's a lot of kind of corny songs that attempt to cash in on what is considered a fad at the time. So you get, you know, Rapping Rodney as in Rodney Dangerfield. You also get Rapping Duke, which a lot of people may know the reference to based on, you know, famous line in Biggie Smalls' Juicy, remember Rapping Duke. There was literally a rap song with a individual who was trying to imitate John Wayne, and I talk in the book about how problematic a figure John Wayne was. So, you know, there's that, but there's also this burgeoning culture. Ultimately, you get a group like Run DMC. So in those early years, you know, I mentioned Michael Jackson, I mentioned Prince. These albums, you know, came out, Thriller, in 1999 when I was in college. And everybody was listening to one or both of those records. But, you know, I wanted to hear the message, you know, Melly Mel and Duke Booty. I wanted to hear Afrika Bambaataa. I wanted to hear later DMC. Because to me, if everybody was listening to it, excuse me, I needed to listen to something else. And hip-hop provided that something else. It was a different culture, a different expression, a different sensibility. And, you know, I've often said I don't follow trends. Trends follow me. And I think about that relative to hip-hop culture itself. That was a long time ago. And so here we are now, and a lot of people probably weren't even born during those days. But it was really interesting because, you know, hip-hop, like one of the chapters in the book, is titled Started from the Bottom. But, you know, here we are, and we're talking about this 50 years later. 50 years is a long time, you know. It's a long time. It's not a fad. It's not a trend. It's not a cycle. It's half a century. And so, you know, when you think about that, it really speaks to how things have changed and evolved. And there's a lot of people who didn't think the culture would be around this long, and hip-hop has outlasted those naysayers and, you know, continues to thrive.
Yeah. Let me go to caller John in San Jose. John, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
Again?
Yeah, so I'm 57, and what stands out to me is the Aerosmith collab with Run DMC and Walk This Way. It just changed everyone's opinion on what could actually be, you know, considered, you know, good music, I think. People were so against rap at the time in the early 80s, mm-hmm. It seems like. I come from a white Northern California area.
Well, John, thanks. You want to talk about that moment, Dr. Boyd?
Well, you know, there was this moment in the mid-'80s in, you know, the influence of what was a relatively new cable network at the time, MTV, which had a problematic history because they didn't want to play videos by black artists. They defined themselves as a rock and roll station, and in their mind that was generally white music. You know, and David Bowie and Rick James and people like this were very public in their criticism. But DMC, from a marketing standpoint, was able to do a collaboration with Aerosmith, and it gave them access to the MTV audience, and, you know, more people heard the music in that way. I don't like that song. I've never liked it. I try to act like it doesn't exist, personally. But in terms of the impact it had on the visibility of Run DMC, I mean, it was huge at that time. But I think it also did a great deal for Aerosmith as well as what it did for hip-hop culture.
Yeah. Let me go to Pulquita, another caller from San Jose. Hi, Pulquita.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me again. This is also one of the things which I see each every time. I see hip-hop bringing the fashion and the trends in this market. I work in the fashion industry past couple of, I can say, about 20 years. I have seen so many changes that hip-hop dance, and even they bring so many sportswear brands like Adidas, Procads, Puma, even the Converse shoes.
Yeah.
All these styles changes accordingly, and then we can just see the bomber jackets and then individualizing hairstyles too, and even the bucket hats, which brings the fashion in through this hip hop dance.
Yeah.
And all the top spot for the fashion picks. So all the trends and fashion also is being connected with the hip hop dance.
Well, Pulquita, thanks for that observation. And certainly hip-hop's relationship, or the relationship that develops and becomes closer and closer with the fashion industry, is definitely something that you cover in Rappers Deluxe. But I did want to talk to you a little bit about some of the early references in Sugar Hill Gang's record, where you talk about the references to clothes, the references to owning things, to cars, to money, to being able to access and purchase things. And you talk about that as informing what hip-hop will become in terms of talking about its aspirations for social mobility. One of the things that I was really struck by is how you talked about the hip-hop dream and how it stepped in to fill the gap left by the American dream. Could you talk a little bit more about that, Dr. Boyd?
Certainly. So, you know, throughout hip-hop's history, there has been a reference to, you know, a metaphor of dreams. You know, I mentioned Biggie Smalls' Juicy earlier. It was all a dream, of course, is the way the song begins. And there are numerous other examples throughout the history of hip-hop, the hip-hop dream. The idea being that the American dream was always an immigrant dream. You know, historically, in the way it's represented, and I speak to, for instance, the influence of the Godfather films is indicative of that, you know, sort of immigrant dream from the early 70s forward, but even before that. But when you think about it, African Americans and Native Americans are not immigrants. And so the very construction of this idea of American dream in and of itself didn't apply to African Americans. And I think historically, you know, there's more than enough evidence to suggest that black people had generally been excluded from that dream. But of course, Martin Luther King famously said he had a dream, and that's a metaphor. But you've had, you know, rappers reference, you know, their version of the dream. And so this idea that hip-hop allowed for the creation of an alternate dream that spoke to individuals in ways that would have contradicted or at least offered an alternative, if not contradicted, to this notion of the American dream. So hip-hop's dream, you know, people have often criticized hip-hop for being, say, materialistic, and I talk about that and the politics behind that. Yeah. But it's part of the culture, you know. I mean, you know, you listen to Rapper's Delight, and he says, I got more clothes than Muhammad Ali, and I dress so viciously. I mean, and so many rappers through the years have referred to what they're wearing, the cars they're driving, the jewelry they're wearing. And one of the things I point to in the book is how when we get to the last chapter, more recently, you know, instead of bragging about cars and sneakers, people are bragging about their art collection, you know, owning Basquiat paintings and other prominent contemporary artists, and influencing the culture in ways far beyond simply, you know, one's personal wardrobe. So this idea of a dream for those excluded from the notion of an American dream allows us to recognize the huge influence that hip hop had in providing people excluded from this with the opportunity to create their own notion of a dream, as opposed to simply being on the margins and watching this larger idea unfold.
Let me go to caller Lucinda in Sausalito. Lucinda, you're on.
Hey, good morning. I am so excited about this topic. Anytime I hear Sugar Hill Gang or DMC, it brings me right back to sixth grade, sitting in the back of the bus. Our album store would print out the words to the, you know, these songs. And as we were being bused from white Brandon, Florida, into the inner city of Tampa, Florida, you know, we were learning these songs, and it brought us together with this culture that, you know, we had never experienced. And so anytime I hear these songs, I'm brought back, you know, to those days. And I was always amazed at the rhymes, like, say hip hip pop, hip to the hippies, hip hip pop, and don't stop rocking to the bang bang boogie. Say up jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to the beat. Anyway, I'm not as good as I used to be, but it just puts a smile on my face. And I have one other memory. I was in St. Thomas, and I got to see Chaka Khan, and I was amazed at how much energy she had. The next day, I'm on a plane to Puerto Rico, and she was on my plane. We're in security, and I got to sing that song, Chaka Khan, Chaka Khan, and I got to tell her about, you know, being on the bus. And so thank you so much for this topic this morning.
Well, listen, thanks for sharing the memory. MK writes, during the last couple years of the 1980s, I worked on the school paper at a liberal arts college in the Midwest. Late at night, we did old school paste up of the paper. We'd listen to Public Enemy on repeat. It seemed the most authentic and represented a powerful voice against forms of injustice. You mentioned Muhammad Ali, or Muhammad Ali is referenced a lot. We're talking right now about the influences on hip hop. Could you talk about the influence of Muhammad Ali?
You know, Muhammad Ali is huge. I mean, even in the kind of current moment when Kendrick Lamar, J. Cole, Drake, Rick Ross are sort of going back and forth, part of what started this contemporary conversation is, you know, J. Cole referring to himself as Muhammad Ali. I mean, he's the perfect reference. You know, Muhammad Ali back in the 60s had rhymes that he would articulate, you know, before his fights. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, of course, is maybe the most famous. But, you know, Ali had rhymes for, you know, his opponents and, you know, the way he would taunt them and you know, sort of psych them out. He's one of the first, you know, cultural figures associated with rhymes long before hip-hop even came along. But then also you talk about the greatest of all time, as he referred to himself, which people now often say the GOAT in hip-hop. This came from Muhammad Ali. But then you could also talk about just what he went through politically when he changed his name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, when he refused to participate in the Vietnam War, was exiled from his sport for 3.5 years before ultimately returning, prevailing at the Supreme Court and regaining his title. There's just so much about Muhammad Ali that's an inspiration and an example to hip-hop culture and American culture, you know, more broadly. LL saying, Mama said, knock you out. I mean, you know, the boxing metaphor, the reference. Ali is huge. And so in the first chapter of the book, I talk a lot about figures like Muhammad Ali who were prominent in the 70s as hip-hop was developing in the underground. And so you could make numerous references to Ali. The champ is here. You know, the braggadocio, the persona, the celebration of the self. I mean, he was a huge cultural figure, and I think he kind of served as a model. You know, rappers like Big Daddy Kane talks about how influenced he was by Ali. So Ali was the perfect model for what would become hip-hop. He was on the scene before hip-hop existed, but hip-hop absorbed many of the lessons he taught, and for this reason, he's still regarded as a dominant icon.
Yeah, and the power of words, as you say, that he really made clear, more powerful than fists.
Words
you mentioned
more powerful than fists, yes.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Kendrick and Drake and J. Cole stuff that's going on. We actually have a question about that I'm going to ask you after the break, because I realize that we are coming up on one right now. We're talking with Dr. Todd Boyd. His book is Rapper's Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World. And we're hearing from you, our listeners, about whether you're a fan and why, what influences you're identifying in American culture, or if it feels just very much America. 866-733-6786, the number. The email address, forum@kqed.org. Our social channels are @KQED Forum. Stay with us for more after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Everybody go hotel, motel, Holiday Inn. You say if your girl starts acting up, then you take a friend. I say skip, dive, what can I say? I can't fit them all inside my OJ, so I just take half and bust them out. I give the rest to Master T so he can shock the house.
I said a M-A-S, a T-E-R, a G with a double E. I said I go by the unforgettable name of the man they call a Master G. Well, my name is known all over the world by all the foxes, ladies, and everything.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about how hip-hop culture has permeated our lives in ways that it's become synonymous with American culture. The way we talk, the way we dress, the way we play our politics, the way we expect sports to be. It's all in part because of hip-hop, and Dr. Todd Boyd has documented and traced this in his new book, Rapper's Deluxe, How Hip-Hop Made the World. And your listeners are calling in and writing in with your questions and comments. The listener asks, what are your thoughts on the biggest hip-hop beef in the last decade, Drake versus Kendrick? What's your take on it? Do you have a favorite? So, Dr. Boyd, there are a lot of people who are talking about this as, you know, one of the biggest battles, or they're sitting back and hoping it will be in a long time. So what is your take on it?
Well, you know, I am what they call an OG. I've been doing this for a long time from the very beginning. So often what transpires these days, I, you know, am an observer, but I don't know that I'm necessarily the target audience. When I think about classic hip hop beefs, what I've been focusing on that, you know, no one else has really bought up. You know, we live in a culture these days where everything is instantaneous. You know, hot take culture is one way to describe it. In the era of the internet and social media, you know, there's this thing I call the content monster, and it has to be fed constantly. When you think about classic hip-hop beefs, you know, LL Cool J and Cool Moe Dee. And Cool Moe Dee has a photograph on his album cover of his Jeep, the tire of his Jeep, running over LL's Kango cap. Or you think about Ice Cube with his song No Vaseline responding to, you know, the members of N.W.A., the group he left behind. Or even, you know, Jay-Z and Nas with the Takeover and later Ether. We didn't have the ability at the time for people to release their response, you know, so quickly. You had to wait. You know, you had to wait until Moe Dee dropped his album to see that photograph. You had to wait until Ice Cube dropped his album to hear No Vaseline. You know, I remember Jay-Z drops the Takeover in like September, and Nas's response came on his album Stillmatic in like November or December. You had to wait for it. Now, you know, it's like Kendrick says something, and everybody's like, what's the response? What's the response? And there's all this pressure, you know, to respond. Honestly, I feel like, you know, people are responding, but maybe it's not their best work. Maybe they're so committed to feeding this content beast, this content monster, that they put something out, but it hadn't really been fully processed in the way that it could be, because they're responding to the moment as opposed to, you know, taking their time. And, you know, Nas took his time and responded to Jay-Z, and the song's a classic. I don't know if what I'm hearing right now, any of these things are going to be considered classics. I think, you know, a lot of thoughts get articulated these days, maybe before they're fully baked and ready to be consumed by the public. So that's my take on it. It's interesting, but it's to me, and perhaps this is generational, doesn't feel as authentic as some of the earlier beefs. It just feels like, you know, people are feeling rushed to respond, and maybe in the process, what they're responding with is not as good as it could be if we didn't have this pressure to, you know, provide content 24/7.
But how is it hip hop? Like, how is a beef competition, that kind of, how is that hip hop?
Well, I mean, you know, competition is an inherent part of the culture. One of the reasons that, you know, a sport like basketball has always been so connected to hip hop, it's you know, it's about competition. You know, who's the best, who has the best rhymes? I mean, you know, freestyles and ciphers and battle raps, all these things are, you know, part of the culture. And, you know, honestly, before hip hop, you know, jazz musicians had what were called cutting sessions, you know, where they would battle, you know, to determine who had the best, you know, musical superiority on their instrument. So competition is what, you know, forces individuals to, you know, be creative and, you know, to do so. You know, we're talking about Muhammad Ali. That's inherent to hip hop, you know. There have been times when it went beyond just lyrical battles, though, and became personal. But I think that sort of competition is what has always made the music good, in that, you know, you say something, somebody wants to counter you. The objective is like being in the NBA. You want to win titles. You know, you want to win individual awards. That same sense of competition has long informed hip-hop, and particularly in the way individuals have engaged in various lyrical battles.
Mm-hmm. Definitely spilled into culture. Daryl in San Francisco is on the line. Daryl, join us. No, I think we just lost Daryl. Let me go to Camellia in Sebastopol. Camellia, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for this topic. I just would love to get your take on kind of the line between enjoyment, respect, cultural appropriation, exploitation, with, you know, the crossover of being a lover of hip hop, but then everything we still need to do as a country, as individuals, to understand the experience of being Black and brown in this country. And I just would love your take on that.
Camellia, thanks.
I think I'll take my answer off the air.
So what do you think? The line between appreciating and appropriating, the line between, you know, entertaining and understanding?
Well, you know, I think that the music has always, the music and the culture more broadly, which is what the book is about, you know, it's like it gives people an entrance. People from outside the culture have a way of, you know, entering the culture by virtue of the music, you know, the fashion, you know, films, et cetera. It's an entrance, and it allows you to connect with the culture, to learn about the culture, to be informed by the culture. But at the same time, you know, I often explain this by saying, you know, let's say someone invites you to their house for dinner. And let's say the person who invited you to their house is someone of a different race or a different ethnicity, different cultural background, and they want to invite you to their home and they want to share their culture with you. You know, you can go to their house and enjoy the food and the music and the conversation, but you're still a guest. You're not the host. And so, you know, if you were to, under these circumstances, go to someone's house and say, you know what, I'm going to take this over. Like, I'm no longer the guest, I'm the host. I think most people would consider that rude and inappropriate. The same thing applies to culture. You know, you can be a guest, you can be a well-informed guest. But I think if you get to a point where you feel like I'm no longer the guest, I'm the host, that's when it becomes appropriation and perhaps exploitation. So you can learn, you can love, you can appreciate, you can celebrate, you can support, but recognize at all times you're a guest. You can be an honored guest, but you're still a guest. And I think if you look at it that way, it kind of explains, you know, how one can embrace the culture and celebrate it without being out of order in terms of trying to take it over or act as though one is in a more powerful position than they actually are relative to their identity.
What are you hoping this book will do with, you know, this tracing, helping us see the extent to which hip hop culture is American culture, hip hop culture has impacted the world? What do you hope people come away with it?
Well, exactly what you just said. I mean, hip-hop culture is not marginal. It's not a subculture. After 50 years, it's the culture. It's American culture. This didn't happen, you know, in some foreign country. It has come to influence people in foreign countries, but the circumstances that created hip-hop are uniquely American circumstances. And so, you know, when I mention hip-hop to people, sometimes I get strange responses. Some people tend to think it's only for kids, and I'm like, well, when you've been around for 50 years, I don't know too many 50-year-old kids. Maybe some people act like kids at 50, but, you know, the calendar would suggest otherwise. But, you know, it's a different way of looking at American culture. It's a different way of looking at American history. It's a different way of looking at American politics. But it is uniquely American. It is the story of a culture that grew up and expanded in America and ultimately went global. But the subtitle of the book, How Hip-Hop Made the World, it's just an interesting way to think about American culture. Through the music, through its influences. It's hip-hop culture, it's black culture, it's ultimately American culture. And I think that's what, you know, I'm really trying to get across is this is not some foreign entity that developed in the shadows somewhere. It's mainstream American culture, and it's been that for some time, and it's necessary for people to be able to identify and appreciate that.
Yeah. So interesting. I just had a conversation about the blackness of country music often so seen as American, and how its blackness is often downplayed or denied. And then hip hop is something that's seen as black, and its Americanness is so often downplayed or denied. Let me remind listeners that you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. And let's take this call from Darwin in Hemet. Darwin, you're on.
Yes. First of all, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
And I wanted to say to you, I'm 73 years old, and I notice I love hip-hop. I love groups like, Sugar Hill, Rapper's Delight. I'm a musician myself. But I just wanted to say the very first group that did rapping that went mainstream across the country on the radio, I mean, they were big time, that don't get the credit they should get. And what they did was rap, and they did it by Congo drums, not instruments as they do today in hip-hop. They were called the Last Poets, and I noticed nobody talked about them, and that was like 1967, 68 when they went mainstream across the radio.
Darwin, thank you. You want to talk about Last Poets, Dr. Boyd?
Well, Last Poets are certainly represented in my book, and yep, they are discussed as one of the influences on hip-hop. The same is true with Gil Scott-Heron. But to me, these, Last Poets weren't rappers. Gil Scott-Heron's not a rapper. Neither is Muhammad Ali. These are figures, who certainly use spoken word in the case of the Last Poets and Gil Scott-Heron. They certainly used music combined with spoken word, but they are before hip-hop. And to call them rappers, I think, in some ways kind of diminishes their influence. They influenced rappers, not the other way around. And of course, later rappers like Common would do songs with the Last Poets. So I talk extensively about the Last Poets and their influence, Gil Scott-Heron and his influence, the Watts Prophets. The book spends some time speaking of these early influences who took the form of spoken word long before hip hop and, say, rap music fully developed, but they influenced what, artists would do later. So I see them as very influential, and I certainly spend the appropriate amount of time acknowledging them in the book.
Well, thanks for the call, Darwin. Let me go to Daryl, who's back, I think. Daryl in San Francisco, join us.
Hey, how you doing? Dr. Boyd, congratulations on your book. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
I started out on the road with De La Soul in 1989. Walk Like a Panther tour, which was LL's tour. And LL, Spaghetti King, Slick Rick, those were the core four groups. And we toured around America and picked up groups along the way where they used to group all the rappers together because they didn't have the audience for it. And we go to the West Coast. NWA was on the tour for a little bit. We go up to Oakland in the Bay Area. Too Short was there. Public Enemy went on the tour with us for a little bit, and it was just a great time. And, I'm reminiscing when I hear what's going on today, and I'm just like, wow, this is amazing. And I ran the gamut of the whole industry. I had a production company. I worked in promotion, and I threw shows with Biggie. I threw shows with Luke. I was all over the place.
Wow.
When I came to the music industry. So I had a good time. Good run, long run. And the industry kind of tanked when, there was bootlegging and Napster and the internet, when they changed the business model, but I changed over, and it's all good. It's all good. I'm a music head to this day, and I tell everybody about it,
Well, Daryl, thanks for sharing your experiences. Wow. I didn't ask you about personally, you talked a little bit how you like to go to things that were subcultures, that were things that were happening, that were underground and so on. But one of the things that you really share is the role that your father played in sort of informing this perspective of yours. Do you want to say a few words about that?
Sure. My father, my father was not a professor of cinema and media studies by no stretch of the imagination. But, you know, he had a record collection. And he was in the clothes. And he would on Sunday go to buy the New York Times, and he'd take me with him when he'd go to buy it. And he subscribed to magazines like Esquire. And he would sit up and watch, you know, Mike Douglas show or Dick Cavett show, these interview shows from that time. And he was fixated on watching the Watergate proceedings. I mean, I'm a little kid, but I'm with my dad, and you know, he took me to see blaxploitation movies and, you know, also movies like The Godfather and The Exorcist and Paper Moon. I mean, so much of the culture that I grew to love was introduced to me by my father. He was a jazz head, so he didn't teach me a lot about jazz, but he mentioned enough about it that he planted a seed, and I went and sort of learned about it myself. So my father's not someone who made a living with anything culturally, but his taste, you know, introduced me to all these things, and I took it to the next level. So that's really the foundation, you know, for me back in the 1970s especially, and this is what informed the first chapter of the book and kind of set me on this path to pursue this myself.
USC's hip-hop professor, Dr. Todd Boyd. The book is Rapper's Deluxe. Thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Mark Nieto, for producing today's segment. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.